Here's a scene from a recent episode of CSI.
Mr. Hughes, your prints were found on crime scene evidence. You're under arrest.
Come with me. Escort this young lady to a car as well.
Those crime scene investigators and their real-life counterparts rely on an innovation that dates back to the early 20th century, forensic science. At that time, as writer Deborah Blum points out, factories were producing a new set of modern poisons, poisons that could be used for murder.
Morphine went into teething medicines for infants. Opium into routinely prescribed sedatives. Arsenic was an ingredient in everything from pesticides to cosmetics. The products of the new chemistry stocked the shelves of doctors' offices, businesses, homes, pharmacies, and grocery stores.
That's Deborah Blum reading from The Poisoner's Handbook, a story about murder and the rise of forensic medicine in Jazz Age New York. Deborah Blum, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Up until the first few decades of the 20th century, it was shockingly easy to poison someone and get away with it, as you write. How was that possible?
There were a number of reasons for that. Partly it was that scientists hadn't really developed the forensic tools they needed. They couldn't always detect a poison in tissue. They hadn't even identified this incredible wash of chemicals that were pouring into society with the rise of the 20th century industrial revolution. The materials that you could pretty much pick up at the corner grocery store. So say that I decided that I wanted to get rid of you and I want to hide it. And so I'm going to pick a poison like arsenic. And arsenic, as it turns out, is fairly tasteless. And if you give it at just the right dose, you could actually make it mimic like a gastrointestinal illness. And so poisoners, before you really had scientists to come in there and say, no, I'm looking at this corpse in autopsy, this does not look like a natural death, they could use arsenic and, you know, very handily pack off whoever they tried to get rid of. In fact, for a while, arsenic had the nickname the inheritance powder because so many people used it to get to the fortune they just couldn't wait for anymore.
And it was untraceable.
Right. And by untraceable, we just mean that scientists don't know how to find it in a body. The science was slowly starting to creep along, but the other part of this formula is the criminal justice system. And if you have good science and cops who don't know how to work with it, you're in the same position as if you have bad science.
And that sets a stage for this real shift that begins when a man named Charles Norris is appointed as the first chief medical examiner in New York City. He elevates this field of research into a high science. How does he do it?
He was determined to make what he did powerful and important and really to change the criminal justice system. He believed that there could not be good criminal detection unless it marched hand in hand with good science.
And of course, all revolutionaries usually have good people next to them or beneath them. And he had this chemist that he sort of tapped named Alexander Gettler, who really, as you describe it, becomes the father of toxicology.
Yes, and you see him and, you know, in sort of the footnotes of textbooks calling him exactly that, the father of American forensic toxicology. And he discovered so many things, and he would lie in bed driving his wife crazy, drawing out formulas and mentally arranging new equipment. And then he would go to his lab and build it because they just didn't have it. Sometimes, literally, they would start a prosecution without knowing how to find the poison. And he would be running these tests during the trial. And the poison labs or the chemistry labs, I think they must have been amazing to be in because a lot of what they did is they could detect poisons according to different colors resulting on tests. So you would have cyanide glowing evening sky blue and arsenic, this translucent green, and carbon monoxide, a ruby red. There was like this incredible blaze of color as they teased these poisons out.
Deborah Blum, I was fascinated by a story you tell about the radium girls, and I just want you to tell that story because it's just unbelievable.
Isn't that incredible? During World War I, people discovered that they could make watch faces glow in the dark, become luminous, and they used a paint that involved the element radium, which had been discovered by Marie Curie and her husband Pierre. And so factories hired young women to paint the numbers and the beautiful lacy luminous designs on watch faces. And radium at the time was considered a kind of miracle element.
It was used in water, right? As sort of healthy water.
That's exactly right. There was a health drink called Radithor, which was full of radium. And the idea was that radium was really like this tiny, healthy sun. It was like this miraculous, sparkling, glowing element. And all you had to do was drink some of this wonderful sunlight radiation, and you too would be strong and healthy forever. The radium girls, as they came to be called, these young women who painted their watch dials, they had no reason to think it was dangerous.
Right.
So not only did they play with it, but they would, to make their brush points very fine, they would lip point them, wet them in their mouth to get a sharp point. And what happened was that after a couple of years, they started dying in these bizarre and mysterious ways and horrible ways. Their jaws literally crumbled. And of course, the factory at first denied that it was anything involved with the factory, and then they suppressed some of the reports. But finally, public health officials started really looking at this, and they discovered, in fact, that this radium was just breaking these bones to pieces within them.
And none of this really would have been discovered without the energy that was thrown into this kind of forensic science by people like Norris and Gettler.
And in fact, Norris and Gettler were involved directly in the radium girl case. Norris was a major public health crusader. He could hardly stand an issue that he couldn't crusade about. And they really went on to harangue the government that they had to stop giving this free rein to anyone who wanted to put radium in anything.
Deborah Blum, how much do modern forensic investigators and pathologists owe to Gettler and Norris?
I think they own an incredible debt. For one thing, Gettler and Norris were part of a movement really born in New York City to make forensics a respectable science, one in which scientists were specifically trained. There were no specific programs in forensic medicine until the 1930s. And they set some really good standards, too, because all of us know that forensics has to be completely meticulous. In a situation where you have people's lives directly hanging in the balance, it has to be right on. And they were so good at that.
That's Deborah Blum. She's the author of The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. She joined me from Madison, Wisconsin. Deborah Blum, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joined now by someone who's going to urge you to grow your own drugs. Nope, we're not talking about the illicit kind. We're talking about a living pharmacy of plants from your own backyard. Fennel and rose hips, echinacea and dandelion, horse chestnuts and nettles. James Wong is an ethnobotanist. He trained at the Royal Botanic Gardens in London, and he's written a medicinal recipe book called Grow Your Own Drugs. It's an offshoot of his BBC television series. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you say at the outset, James, you are not against conventional medicine, but you look all around you at plants and you see these little, bright, beautiful chemical factories.
That's a really good way of putting it, actually. I think so many people have this stereotyped idea of what herbal medicine is. And I think they've almost got a big black line in their minds that separates serious, conventional, tested scientific medicine on one side and slightly airy-fairy, away with the hippies, you know, natural but probably doesn't work, plant-based medicine on another. And I think it's really important as a scientist to show that this sort of big black line that so many people have in their minds is really a cultural idea, not a scientific one. You know, to me as a scientist, whether a chemical is found within a pill or the cells of a plant is really irrelevant. I mean, that's just packaging. It's whether, you know, there's a plausibility that it works or not. So I'm totally not against conventional medicine. I mean, I'm the person who's popping aspirin whenever I've got the opportunity. But, you know, if I'm at home and I've got things to hand, I might well make an extract using willow bark, for example, an extract using meadowsweet, which are the plants that aspirin was first derived from, and in many senses can be seen as in some ways superior and in some ways practical, depending on your situation.
You have recipes in this book for remedies for just a wide range of ailments, everything from hot flashes to eczema to arthritis. And I want to talk about your treatment for something that has driven so many parents and children to complete distraction, head lice.
Conventional medicine or conventional treatments for head lice, in the UK at least, are proving increasingly problematic in treating head lice because head lice are becoming immune to the chemicals that are traditionally used. So there is a big interest in looking at alternatives. And one of these is neem oil that we use. Neem oil works in an entirely different way as an insecticide. It actually mimics the chemicals, hormones that an insect has in its body. And it basically sends off the wrong chemical messages to the insect. So it produces lots of problems with it feeding, it reproducing, and it molting. But it's entirely safe for all mammals, just toxic to insects.
What is neem oil?
Neem oil is an oil that's produced from a tree, a subtropical tree native to India, and it's quite widely available in health food shops, and it's not particularly expensive either.
I can imagine skeptical parents everywhere right now listening to this and wondering, does it really work?
Well, I would say to that, give it a go. As with all herbal remedies, they don't necessarily come with guarantees. And if you've tried conventional stuff and it hasn't, I don't think there's any harm in giving it a go.
And you have the neem oil in your recipe mixed up with almond oil, garlic cloves, tea tree oil, rosemary, lavender, I guess, just to smell pretty.
Actually, all of those ingredients have been used traditionally for their insecticidal properties. It's the essential oils within them that's the key insecticidal compound. I think in human terms, when you think of how long we've been battling with insects, we're talking a couple of thousand years. When you think about how long plants have been waging sort of warfare with insects, this goes back millions of years. And over that huge period, there's been time for them to evolve all sorts of unusual strategies, many of which are natural chemical weapons, insecticides that exist in the environment that can be used in all manner of ways. It's really many of the recipes that I've used are basically about hijacking chemicals that plants have evolved for themselves and using them to treat people and animals.
You have a recipe in here for treating athlete's foot with a garlic foot bath, a lot of garlic, some sage leaves, cider vinegar, and that you say will cure what ails you if you've got athlete's foot.
Well, all of those ingredients have antifungal properties, particularly garlic, and in particular the concentration that we're using them at. Plenty of garlic, plenty of sage, plenty of lavender, and one of my key things that I wanted to get across in this book and series is that natural medicine doesn't have to be about trekking off to the Amazon. It's about plants that are growing in and around your neighborhood that are accessible to you. And, you know, when you're thinking about lavender and sage, so many people have got them in their back garden anyway. And things like garlic and sage are probably in your spice rack. It's about things that are easy and accessible, and you don't need any more equipment than, you know, I used to have in my student kitchen when I knocked them up at university.
Now, a few caveats we should toss in here. You say if you're sick, you should, of course, talk to your doctor. Do not self-diagnose.
Very much so. I'm an ethnobotanist by training, which is a scientist that studies the use of plants. I'm not medically trained. There are all sorts of interesting solutions that are found in the plant world. But, you know, you need to be responsible. You need to make sure that you have a proper diagnosis and know exactly what you've got. And, you know, once you've got that, you can consider using plant-based remedies as part of the solution. But it's very much not about abandoning conventional medicine. It's almost like a useful complement to it.
And also you say, know what you're picking. Be very careful of poisonous plants, of course.
That's a very important thing. I think, you know, as a botanist, it's quite easy to forget that to the layman, you know, there are lots of poisonous plants that are morphologically in their shape very, very similar to perfectly useful plants. And it really is important to get a good guidebook and, you know, visually identify exactly what you're looking for.
James, do you have an all-time favorite medicinal plant?
Oh, gosh. It really is like picking between your children. You might have one, but you wouldn't like to say it to make the other ones feel bad. What would I say? I'd say probably garlic. It's my favourite, although it's not particularly exotic and far-flung and unusual. But it's my favourite probably because of all those things. It's so widely available. You can get it in whichever country in the world you're at. So easy to grow. It tastes brilliant, but it has such a huge range of medicinal uses. It's antifungal, it's antibacterial, and it's antiviral. So really, with all of those uses combined, it's just such a one-stop shop. You just have to pick it.
James Wong is the author of Grow Your Own Drugs. James, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
And at npr.org, you can find his recipes for treatments for head lice and athlete's foot, along with a recipe to add some fizzy fun to your bath.
We're taking the long view this week, our occasional series with people of long experience. Today, a man of faith and fight, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, whose new book is called Made for Goodness. During apartheid, Archbishop Tutu railed against the injustice and inhumanity of South Africa's government. Now 78, in a magenta habit with a silver crucifix around his neck, he is the picture of a holy man. Looking back on his boyhood in a black township, Archbishop Tutu remembers an urchin with a fondness for marbles and comic books, which led me to ask, did you like going to church as a child?
We had fun. I mean, I still remember things like, if God be for us, if God be for us, who can be against us? Who can be against us, against us? And it was a fantastic thing to have much, much later to remember. Yes, if God before us in our struggle against injustice and oppression, who can be against us? But yeah, and I have to say, the first Anglican priest I met was an incredible human being, a black priest. And we used to go with this priest to farms where he had mission churches. The priest was treated like a big chief, you know, when he arrived. I mean, each time I still remember this incredible priest who had this degree of caring for lesser mortals. And who knows? I mean, I was probably seeking to emulate him.
As a teenager, you nearly died of tuberculosis.
Yes.
You spent months institutionalized in a TB hospital. And for someone that at that age, you suddenly see the possibility of your own death.
Yes. Yes, I was in hospital for 20 months. We were in a general ward. And I'd observed in the ward that almost all of the patients who coughed up blood ended up going to the, you call it a morgue, we call it a mortuary. And one day, this thing happened to me. I coughed, and the blood just came gushing out of my mouth. And I sat, and I still can't believe that that happened, but I sat there, and I said to God, well, if it means I'm going to die, that's okay. I don't think I've ever felt that same kind of peace, the kind of serenity that I felt after acknowledging that maybe I was going to die of this TB.
It was interesting to find out in the book that your first idea of who you would be, what your career would be, was that you would be a doctor. But yes, you couldn't afford to go to medical school.
Yes.
And then ultimately to go into the ministry, you described what? That you were grabbed by the scruff of the neck by God?
Well, I mean, my first love was medicine. And especially after getting TB, I was determined I wanted to be able to find a cure. But I was admitted to medical school, but my parents didn't have the money to pay the fees. So, you know, one of my favorite prophets is Jeremiah. In part, it is because Jeremiah is such a crybaby. And I also tend to be a crybaby. I holler at the drop of a hat, as it were. But Jeremiah also was saying he didn't want to become a prophet and said to God, if I say I don't want to speak on your behalf, your word is like a fire in my breast. I can't hold it back. And sometimes when people asked why I was going on in the fashion I was, despite the reaction of the government and all of their nastinesses, and I said, well, although we claim that we have a free will, in some ways, God just grabs us by the scruff of the neck and willy-nilly you have to do what it is that God wants you to do.
Jumping ahead to the late 1990s, you were asked by Nelson Mandela to become the chairman of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yes.
You had to sit through some very terrible stories.
Yeah.
Some of them, many of them, we couldn't relate right now on a morning radio show. Did you ever find that your faith in the basic goodness of people was shaken?
No. Perhaps if one had listened only to the atrocities, an account of the atrocities that people committed, but we were constantly being bowled over by the extent to which people were ready and willing to forgive. But, I mean, we had, obviously, the spectacular example of Nelson Mandela, who could come out of 27 years incarceration so eager to be able to forgive.
Have you found that your relationship to God has changed as you've grown older?
Yes. I am learning to shut up more in the presence of God. You know, previously, I mean, you want, and I still do, I mean, you have a kind of shopping list that you bring to God. But more and more, I think you are trying to grow in just being there. Like when you sit in front of a fire in winter, you are just there in front of the fire, and you don't have to be smart or anything. The fire warms you.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, thank you very much for joining us.
God bless you. Thank you.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu's new book is Made for Goodness.